The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you from Campbell Hall, WILL, AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a tape show, taped just a couple days before we went on air because I have to be out of town on Sunday for a West Coast trip. But we have a terrific show with a guest we've had on the air before here at Media Matters, Robert Jensen. Bob Jensen's a professor of media law, ethics, and politics at the University of Texas, Austin. He's the author of Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, among other books. He's written for a lot of different media over the years. And he has a brand new book out, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, published by City Lights Book. Welcome to Media Matters, Bob Jensen.
Great to be with you, Bob.
So how long has Citizens of the Empire been out now?
It just came out about a month or two ago, and I've started to do a lot of traveling, getting around the country as much as I can to talk to people, not just about the book, but really the issues that are raised in the book. This is an interesting time in American politics. The media are, you know, putting forth a steady stream of the conventional wisdom, which is what they typically do. But when I go out on the road, I'm struck by how hungry people are for an alternative perspective. People come to bookstore talks, people come to campus talks, and they've been reading the alternative press, and they want to engage in a discussion that I think they really just can't find in other places. So that's a very, I think, hopeful sign about the state of politics in the country.
Now, Citizens of the Empire, is this one of these bogus books where you take a few newspaper articles and cobble them together?
No, I've never been fond of people who write columns and then every two or three years assemble them, because it's rare that somebody can write something and it'll still be all that meaningful two or three years ago. It is based on a lot of the work I did right after 9/11 and during the run-up to the Iraq War. I was writing a lot, both for websites, for mainstream newspapers, and I took that and tried to take the best of it, that is, the themes that seem to really resonate with people. For instance, there's a chapter on patriotism, and I had been writing about patriotism in a variety of different ways for the past couple of years. So I tried to bring all of that together and put a contemporary spin on it, connected to the issues at the moment. Of course, Iraq was the most important question. And provide a coherent way for people to think through some of what I think are the primary political questions in front of us today. How to think through the rhetoric that the mainstream gives us, how to think about why we're in the particular political dilemmas we're in, and then the final section of the book is really about how to think our way out of them, where to go if nothing else, a sense of hope that change can happen.
Bob Jensen, author of the new book, Citizens of the Empire. Bob, you've been, I think over the past several years, one of the strongest critics of mainstream journalism in the United States, particularly, though not exclusively, of its coverage of the U.S. role in the world, in particular the U.S. wars in Afghanistan. For a long time, the U.S. sort of quiet war against Iraq, and then since last year, the explicit invasion and occupation of Iraq. I mean, what for the listeners who aren't really familiar with these issues, especially, let's talk about Iraq, since that is the number one story in the news nowadays. What have been the limitations over the last 2 years, say, of the press coverage of the Iraq War for the average American watching TV news, reading their daily newspaper? What is the news coverage getting wrong?
Well, here I think it when there are wars and the run up to war and in general times of great national crisis, we see what the mainstream news media tend to get wrong all the time, but we tend to see it in more concentrated form. So if you think about the good left progressive critical scholarship on media and what shapes media coverage, for instance, the propaganda model that Ed Herman developed, a lot of the work you've done, other people, have sketched out pretty clearly why this happens and how it happens. You have influences on news content. You have the fact that it's corporately owned and its revenue stream is from advertising. You have the professional practices of professional journalism, which, of course, the main facet of which is that it overemphasizes official sources. It privileges the news that comes from people in power. Mostly in this culture, of course, that means the government and the corporate sector. And finally, there's the role of ideology. I always say the most important thing to realize about American journalists is they are Americans. They are raised and educated in this country, and we all get a certain story taught to us about the role of the United States and the role of capitalism and all these sorts of big questions. Well, if you look at how that plays out in the coverage of war or in foreign policy and U.S. military policy more generally, what you see is that all of these problems that exist day-to-day in coverage really intensify so that, for instance, the problem of over-reliance on official sources. If you look at the run-up to the Iraq War, even though all over the country and all over the world there were alternative perspectives, there were people with different kinds of information available, the U.S. commercial news media was overwhelmingly dominated by the voices of the powerful within the United States. That means the State Department, the Defense Department, and the weapons contractors, the White House, of course. That shaped news to such an overwhelming degree that alternative perspectives, when they did get in, got in only on the margins. They got in only as a sort of almost an afterthought to the news that really mattered, which was what was coming out of state, what was coming out of defense. And not to go on too long, but there's one important thing to realize, that within that you can get coverage that looks critical. So, for instance, sometimes there will be debates between people in the Defense Department and people at state. This is most often given to us as the big struggle in the administration between Colin Powell and the diplomats at state and Donald Rumsfeld and the hawks at defense. Well, there are these kinds of disputes within administrations, but they're presented to us as real debate when, in fact, the news media is missing the real debate, which is that the United States was virtually isolated in the world in wanting to go to war. And all of those arguments, all of that information, all of the analysis that was circulating all over the world was not circulating in the mainstream commercial corporate press in the U.S. And in that sense, the American public, I think, really can't be said to have supported the war, because I don't think the American public ever had information about what the war was. It supported an image of the war that was given to us by the administration's spinmeisters, but that's about all you can say.
Well, you know, the main issues that were used to justify the U.S. invasion of Iraq, as I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, were the idea that legally they said that there was an imminent threat from weapons of mass destruction that Saddam Hussein possessed, and that was the closest thing to a legal argument that would justify by international law an invasion. And then there was sort of the implied argument that Iraq was connected to terrorism and been a cell for terrorism, and so taking out Iraq would be a crucial part of clearing out the terrorist network of the Middle East. And then I think down the road a ways was also the argument that Saddam Hussein was a really bad guy, and just getting rid of a bad guy is a good thing, even if you know the ends justify the means, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And the first two of those have certainly been discredited, I think, clearly, since the war began. That's not even the White House acknowledges more or less. Certainly everyone understands more or less now those are discredited. How much is the media responsible for this war then, in that case, to the extent that they, you know, did not challenge these claims before the war began?
I think the media is responsible to an extraordinary degree, more than perhaps in any other conflict in U.S. history, because, as you point out, there were two primary and then one sort of marginal reason given. And the ones that really mattered, because they motivated people to support the war, were the terrorist ties, alleged terrorist ties, and the alleged weapons of mass destruction. Now, it's often said that after the war was over, we now have come to understand those were fraudulent reasons. But the problem is, before the war, we knew those were fraudulent reasons. That is, if one was reading the web or looking at the foreign press or even marginally plugged in to alternative information sources, we knew that none of those reasons held water at all. So how did people come to believe them? And in fact, we should note, how do they still believe them? That is, there are still polls being taken that show that sometimes more than a majority of the American public believe that, this one just came out, I think, earlier this week, 57% of Americans still continue to believe that the war, that before the war in Iraq, Saddam Hussein and his regime was providing substantial support to al-Qaeda. Well, that's, as you point out, that's factually incorrect. There is absolutely no evidence for it. It's not a contentious question, excuse me. There is absolutely no evidence for it. Well, how did people come to believe that? They came to believe that because of the way in which the Bush administration framed the issue, the hints the Bush administration gave, and how did those things get to the U.S. public? Well, the White House, of course, has its own, you know, advertising campaign of sorts, but the primary channel for that is the commercial corporate news media. So here I think the responsibility, you could say the moral culpability lies square with the media. And it's not the case that they can now say, well, gee, we just had no way of knowing before the war. If there was really no way the American news media could have done anything else, then they would be blameless in a sense. But the fact is, media all over the world were challenging those assertions. Media all over the world were offering different analysis, looking to different sources. So the U.S. news media, I think, is a primary vehicle for propaganda in this context, and therefore shoulders a lot of the blame for why this war happened, again, nominally with public support, although I don't think the public ever really knew what was happening.
We're talking to Bob Jensen today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Robert Jensen is the author of the brand new book, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, just published by City Lights Book. And Bob Jensen is a professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. Okay, so the news media blew it going into the war, getting us into that war. But, you know, now that the war was, the initial invasion was a success and they toppled the government, they've learned from their mistakes, right? Are they getting it right now? You know, in the past month or two, we've seen all sorts of fighting, activity between the United States and Iraqis. You know, is the news media learned from their errors and now sort of presenting a much more accurate view of what's taking place there, in your view?
If only that were the case. Of course, the commercial corporate news media, and I keep using that phrase because we have to remember, of course, there are alternative sources. In the U.S., there is access to non-U.S. publications that can be very informative. But the mainstream corporate commercial press in the United States has continued to drop the ball. First of all, they're finally catching up on some of these stories about the fraudulent nature of the case that was made for war. But here, even after the fact, they're still, I think, getting it wrong because they're making, essentially the claim that's being made is, listen, Bush lied about some of the information about weapons of mass destruction, and therefore he went on, or you know, somehow the war went forward for the wrong on a claim that can't be defended. But what all of that reporting misses is the fact there was a reason the war went forward. The Bush administration, just like every other U.S. administration, has been seeking control over the oil resources of the Middle East. Everybody understands that, at least everybody outside the U.S. And the war went forward for a reason that was perfectly plausible, that is, to deepen and extend American power and dominance in the strategically crucial Middle East. But as long as the press continues to argue back and forth about the evidence for weapons of mass destruction and who in the administration was responsible for it, was it CIA's fault, was it this intelligence operation within the Defense Department, were they really to blame? Because that all takes for granted the fact that the war was about weapons and the question is whether the information was good or not. Now, that said, is the press doing a better job of simply covering what's happening on the ground? And I think that there is good reporting going on. We should always acknowledge that within this big enterprise we call corporate journalism, there's a lot of good reporting because it's a system that isn't totalitarian in nature. It does give people the chance to do good work here and there. And I've read some very good stories about what's happening in Iraq within the mainstream press. But the overall picture that we're getting, and here television does a much worse job than the newspapers, I think, is of a sort of beleaguered American military trying its best to bring peace, freedom, and justice to Iraq. And is that what's really happening? Is that what really happened in Fallujah, for instance? So General Kimmett gets up at the briefings and talks about the precision weapons and how the U.S. military goes to such lengths to prevent civilian casualties. And for the most part, the media channels that story to us. But anybody who's been reading the work of people who were on the ground in Fallujah know that there were massive civilian casualties. As many as, and perhaps more than half of the people killed in Fallujah were women, children, and obvious non-combatants. And that doesn't even start to deal with the bigger question of what's going on in Fallujah. Is it, in fact, the U.S. trying to protect the people of Fallujah, or is it, in fact, an attack, a kind of collective punishment on the people of Fallujah? All of these things, which are, again, widely discussed in the foreign press and the alternative press, are pretty much boxed out of the American mainstream press. And unfortunately, we're still not getting the quality and depth of information we need.
We're talking to Bob Jensen today on Media Matters. Bob is the author of the new book, Citizens of the Empire, published by City Lights Book. And he's joining us in a show we've taped a few days before going on air. So please do not try to call in today with calls or comments for Bob Jensen. Bob, while we're on the subject of Iraq and before we turn to your book, two journalists gained a lot of attention about a little over a year ago as the invasion of Iraq was unfolding, who worked for the New York Times. Yet the two have had very different careers. One was Jason Blair and the other was Judith Miller. And I was wondering if you could just talk about their two incidents and what that tells us about the values of our journalism today.
I think that is probably the single most important comparison we could make to understand what's really going on in American journalism. Jason Blair, of course, was the young reporter who falsified information and plagiarized information for his stories in the New York Times over a number of years. It was a scandal and should have been a scandal when journalists who are allegedly writing nonfiction make stuff up. That's bad. I think everybody can agree with that. But we can look at the sort of the sins of Jason Blair and ask, what was the consequence of them? Well, the consequence of them is fairly minor. There was a breach of trust, and trust is important when any profession holds itself out to the public as doing work of value. So I don't want to minimize what Jason Blair did. On the other hand, you point out Judith Miller. Judith Miller is another New York Times reporter who is their weapons of mass destruction star. She's the one who's been writing about this for quite a long time. Well, it turns out that many of the stories that Judith Miller wrote in the run-up to the Iraq War were based on fraudulent information, often from sources she was very close to. And in fact, it can be argued, I think, persuasively, that the reporting of Judith Miller and people like Judith Miller helped create in the public mind in the United States the false belief that Saddam Hussein obviously had weapons of mass destruction. Now, Judith Miller has received no punishment for her misreporting. Jason Blair was fired, which was appropriate. But the question is, what should have happened to Judith Miller? In the case of Judith Miller, her mistakes, her errors, her fraudulent reporting, whether it was intentional or not, the reality is the consequences of her reporting is that a public was led to believe things contrary to fact, which helped build public support for a war, which has now been shown to be the disaster that many of us predicted it would be. Well, it seems to me the consequences of Judith Miller's unprofessional reporting are considerably more serious than that of Jason Blair, yet we see that instead of being fired or even being publicly reprimanded, what has happened to Judith Miller is she continues on with her career, and in fact, the editors of the New York Times, when challenged about these very facts, which have been brought up in public, the editors of the New York Times supported her, continue to support her, and have yet to recognize the severity of the problems with her reporting and the consequences of it.
Bob Jensen, you just mentioned the term lack of professionalism in her reporting. Some critics of mainstream journalism are also critical of the very notion of professional journalism, of objectivity. What's your take on the idea of journalism being professional, of its being objective?
Yeah, I guess I sort of used the term professional somewhat sarcastically there. I think that the way we have to separate in questions about objectivity, common sense ways that we use that term and what it means within the profession. I always tell my students, if objectivity means a commitment to not making stuff up and a commitment to keeping an open mind so that you can report on and understand facts that don't necessarily fit your predisposition, well, if that's what objectivity means, I'm all for objectivity, and in fact, I'm for objectivity not only for reporters but for everybody. But the reality is what objectivity means within commercial journalism today is really a set of practices. Objectivity is defined as a way of going about reporting the news. And again, the key feature of objective journalism these days is the over-reliance on those official sources, on those sort of primary definers of news. And that kind of objectivity, you could almost make the argument, produces very unobjective news by that more common sense definition. My own view is that in this world we would be much better off if we stopped fretting about the concept of objectivity and started asking a different question about journalists, which is, are they truly independent? Now, when we see state-controlled media, let's say you've got a totalitarian society, and all of the major mass media are controlled by the government, the one thing we know for sure is that the journalists are not independent. That is, they don't have real freedom to report wherever that inquiry might lead them. And we can say that's not, in a sense, real journalism because it's not independent. It's information, it's being conveyed in journalistic forms, you know, television, news stories, all sorts of things. But we think of it as something less than real journalism. And I think that's appropriate. But if we're going to ask questions about independence, we also have to ask questions about how independent mainstream commercial journalism is in the United States. And here again, we can point to the run-up to the Iraq War, where although journalists had the broad protections of freedom of expression, freedom of the press and speech that we have in this country, the news they reported was slavishly tied to the administration. Now, is that real independence? Does that kind of legal guarantee of freedom, but a kind of over-reliance on power as the official, not only sort of sources for news, but really definers of news, is that independence? Well, from the critical analysis that lots of people have offered, including yourself, I think the conclusion is it's not really independent because it's subordinated to the dominant power in the culture, which, again, in this country means essentially the state system and the corporate system. And I think that's how we should be evaluating journalists. Are they independent? Are they really free to go down any road that the critical inquiry they engage in will lead them? That's a question we could ask about professors as well. It's a question you can ask about anybody in a society who's given the right to produce and distribute information. You look at the structures in which they work. You look at them, the rules under which they work, and you ask the question, are they really independent?
We're talking to Bob Jensen today here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Bob Jensen is the author of the new book, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. And let's talk a little bit about the book now, because it, while it covers some of the issues we're talking about now, it also takes a bigger sweep and also tries to look at a way out of the impasse that you described that we're in. In the book, you go through some of the sort of common, what's the term you use here for that?
The kind of rhetorical fog.
Yeah, rhetorical fog. And you have a few chapters that go through some of the foggiest fogs out there. Fog number one is the idea that the United States is the greatest nation on earth. Well, aren't we?
Well, you know, that's in a sense, that's the most primary claim that politicians in this country make. It falls easily off the lips of Republicans, Democrats, virtually everybody.
Yeah, has any politician ever said, by the way, we're number seven?
But the point of it is, on one level, it's just a ludicrous claim. I mean, nations are complex entities. You know, we have nearly 300 million people in the United States and in a very complex society. So if you're going to say anybody or any nation is the greatest, the first question is, on what criteria? In other words, a nation is a lot of things. Are we the greatest in some on some checklist? You know, we have the best healthcare system, the best education system. You know, what exactly does the claim mean? Well, of course, like many rhetorical political claims, it doesn't really mean much of anything. Nobody is the greatest at anything. In the book, I use the example, if your child, you know, if your 10-year-old kid came to you and said, Dad, I'm the greatest 10-year-old in the world, well, the first thing you would do is sort of read the kid the Riot Act, make sure the kid understood that no one is the greatest, that's a claim that doesn't really make any sense. And if you go beyond that and you wanted to take it seriously, well, then the question would be, well, are we the greatest? Let's take some of those issues. What about health care? Well, you don't have to look around too far to see other industrial nations who do a much better job of providing health care to all their citizens. Education. You can see other societies in which real quality education, public education, is free to everyone. Okay, what about the history of the United States? People say, well, you're picking nits. What about just the whole history of freedom? Well, here, you know, maybe if the facts matter, we would want to look at history. We would want to look at the conduct of the United States around the world. We'd want to take seriously what it means to make the claim you're the greatest nation on earth within living memory of the Vietnam War, one of the most, you know, egregious war crimes ever fought or ever conducted in the post-World War II era. I mean, if once you start subjecting that claim to even a minimal amount of scrutiny, it not only falls apart sort of intellectually, the whole claim doesn't make any sense, but then you have to ask some unpleasant questions about contemporary U.S. society and U.S. history, and then the whole thing just starts to become ludicrous. And those are the things that people need to be able to engage when they hear people say, you know, we're the greatest nation on earth. We have to learn to respond to them in a way that can really point out some of these things, I think.
This is almost like a religious mantra, though, isn't it? It's sort of like questioning the existence of God when you're in a Sunday school.
Yeah, and, you know, there's been a lot of talk in the U.S. about the civic religion of the United States, which, you know, it often goes by the term this belief in American exceptionalism. And I think it's important to you know, think about that. It's often claimed, you know, without evidence or without any sensible argument, but it's claimed that the United States is somehow an exception to history, that, you know, the history of nation states like the Europeans is this brutal, ugly, colonial, violent kind of history, but somehow the United States is outside of that, that the United States, and for some people this has a theological element to it, was, you know, that shining city on the hill, to go back to the early days, even before the United States was a nation.
The second chapter in the fog is titled Support the Troops. Is that a call for your readers to support the troops?
No, I think that's another one of those rhetorical devices we have to learn to resist, because on the surface, of course, nobody wants to be seen as somebody who doesn't support the troops, because that implies you don't care if they live or die, and that seems callous. But we have to step back and say, again, what does the claim, or the in this case, the question, what does it even mean? If somebody says to me, I want you to support the troops, are they asking me to do something tangible? Are they asking me to, you know, send a care package to the troops? What are we being asked to do? Well, if you look at it, the claim or the question, do you support the troops, is really a way to undermine critical inquiry and dissent and questioning about what the troops are doing. The question isn't about the troops. The question is about the policy that the troops are implementing. And if the claim that you have to support the troops is simply used to undermine criticism of the policy, then that's a fundamentally anti-democratic rhetorical strategy, because it's trying to divert people from engaging in the work of citizens, which is to scrutinize the policies that the leadership engage in and critique them, and when it's appropriate, try to change them. But if it all stays at this level, it's kind of a feel-good level of support the troops. Well, I don't even know what that means. It's almost empty question.
Any government can make that claim for any possible military action.
Yeah, and it sounds a bit over the top, perhaps, to ask people, well, if you were in Germany in 1941, would the claim, do you support the troops, be meaningful? Well, no, because in that case, it's so egregious. We can step back and say, well, of course we don't support the troops in that sense, because the troops are engaged in aggressive warfare and acts of genocide. Well, that's the point. Are we going to be free to evaluate the policy, or are we going to allow ourselves to be, in a sense, cordoned off by a question that has great emotional power but has no real political meaning?
And what's interesting, Bob Jensen, author of Citizens of the Empire, is that there's a great deal of evidence emerging in the past few months that, in fact, military families in the United States are having serious questions about the Iraq War themselves. Mm-hmm. It's far from a high-five, back-slapping session when military families get together now and consider what their loved ones are doing in Iraq.
Of course, because not only are they being subject to, you know, the threats that come with being in war, but it's becoming increasingly clear that they're engaged in a really illegitimate exercise. That is, they are not bringing freedom to the Iraqi people. In fact, much of the Iraqi population doesn't want them there. So that's bound to create, within the soldiers and within their families, a kind of critical questioning. But beyond that, I think that military families are also realizing that their loved ones, their brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers, are, in a sense, nothing more than cannon fodder to this government too. Their hitches are being extended. They sometimes don't even have the proper equipment when they're over there. We know the scandals of the VA system in this country, the Veterans Administration, the lack of health care for veterans. We know the way in which the government dragged its feet, acknowledging originally the health effects on veterans of Agent Orange from the Vietnam War, or Gulf War syndrome, or now we're facing what is almost certainly going to be a similar situation on exposure to depleted uranium weapons. So in a sense, these families are under no illusions about what the U.S. government thinks about the soldiers. And I think that's an important and potentially very radical moment where people start to understand that governments, that the great powers of this world, they conduct policy not on the basis of the interests of ordinary people, either in this country or abroad. They're playing a different game, and that's the game of power and profits, and that's not surprising either. That's the game that the elites have been playing as long as there have been elites, as far as I can tell.
We're talking to Robert Jensen today on Media Matters. Bob Jensen's the author of the new book, Citizens of the Empire. We taped this show a few days before going on air, so please do not try to call in. Bob, while we're on the subject, let's talk about Iraq a little bit more, because I think your comments about the soldiers hearken to the situation in Vietnam, which I think, you know, it was interesting. The Vietnam War, the United States were told it was a civil war in which the United States was going in to fight with the Vietnamese on their behalf against North Vietnamese invaders who were trying to conquer the Free South. And then soldiers went over there and found basically the war between American troops and Vietnamese troops. There wasn't room any Vietnamese on the U.S. side, and there were a lot. The whole opposition was entirely Vietnamese. Is that similar to what's taking place now in Iraq? I mean, is there an Iraqi allied force that will be doing the U.S.'s bidding? What do you foresee going on there in the next few months or next few years?
Well, in a sense, this is a story not only about the U.S. in Vietnam, the U.S. in Iraq. It's a story of attempts at colonial, the attempts by colonial powers to control societies. There's always, in any society, an elite that will ally itself with the occupying power or the colonial power. You can call it a collaborator force. You can call it, you know, elites who've been bought off. You can call it whatever you like. But that's true in virtually any colonial situation. So the fact that there will be Iraqis who take the side of the U.S. is not surprising. And in fact, in Iraq, especially when the U.S. invasion first went forward, it wasn't surprising, given the brutality of the regime of Saddam Hussein, that many Iraqis, even though they might not have welcomed a U.S. invasion in principle, were happy to see Saddam Hussein gone. But what we saw is how quickly that turned, how an Iraq that was, in a sense, it would have been very possible for the U.S. to build allies within that society. The U.S., because of its policies, went forward and systematically alienated virtually all the allies, so that even this past week, the Kurdish leader of the Iraqi Governing Council, who's been one of the U.S.'s most steadfast allies, condemned the U.S. attack on Fallujah. So even our allies are starting to say, listen, you know, this is just, what's going on is insane. And that's a pattern that has taken place not only with the U.S., but with any colonial power. And it's hard to come to terms with this, I think, for the American public, because we want to believe. Nobody wants to believe their own government is this corrupt, this venal, this violent, and has so little respect for both the rights of people abroad and for the health and welfare of people at home. And so people want to believe that we're there for other reasons, that we're there to liberate. But, you know, this is the painful process that comes when you decide you want to deal with the truth and not just with mythology and propaganda.
Well, the United States asserts that Saddam Hussein was a very bad guy who gassed his people and was a terrible human rights record and was anti-democratic. It was not a free society. And that this liberation of Iraq is all about putting into place a self-governing free society. In fact, there's going to be a transfer of power, if I'm not mistaken, very soon. You question that? You don't think that's the case?
Well, this transfer of power, which was always simply a fig leaf to try and con the world, is now become laughable. The administration itself admitted last week that this so-called transfer of sovereignty on June 30th is not going to mean that the Iraqis actually run their own country, that the United States military will continue to make all decisions about the deployment of military power, and in fact that the Iraqi, this transitional government, will not even be allowed to pass laws. So you've got a government with sovereignty that doesn't control its own the use of military force within its own boundaries and can't pass laws. Well, that's a very unusual conception of sovereignty. What it means, of course, is there's no sovereignty and there's going to be no meaningful transfer of power. Everyone understands around the world that an occupying army cannot be the vehicle for liberating a society. The United States went into Iraq for reasons, and they were reasons of strategic control. And again, you know, George Bush can contest that all he wants, but all over the world, people are well aware of that. As long as that is true, it's quite clear the United States cannot and should not be trusted to be the vehicle for bringing democracy to Iraq. So this transfer of sovereignty is a fraud. Everybody understands it. The United States quite clearly has no intention of leaving Iraq in military terms over the probably the long term. That is, there are going to be as many as 14 permanent military bases in Iraq if the U.S. gets its way. And that means any Iraqi government that takes power, as long as the U.S. has the power to control this, is going to be a government that does the U.S.'s bidding. And there's no way that can be part of a transfer to democracy. That's simply a continued presence of American troops to ensure that a government hospitable to U.S. interests is in place.
Do you think this is going to be an issue in the 2004 presidential election?
Well, one would hope it would. I can't imagine a more important issue. We have a nation that was led to war by the overt manipulation of the Bush administration, lies that were told front and center in public, and if nothing else, we should ask the question, does it matter that an American president lied to the people about what could be argued is the most important decision leaders make, which is to go to war? Does that matter? Well, to me, it matters. And, of course, George Bush isn't the first person to have done that. But, you know, beyond that, the incompetence, the way in which this occupation of Iraq has been handled so badly, should raise questions. It should be at the center of any election campaign, as not only in terms of critique of the Bush administration, but critique of John Kerry's inability to make a meaningful analysis of the situation. That should be part of the election campaign, too. But unfortunately, you know, it's kind of a truism in American politics that domestic issues tend to drive campaigns. I know those of us who consider ourselves part of the peace movement, the anti-war movement, what I might simply call the anti-empire movement, that many of us would like these to be part of the campaign and are doing things to try and make it so. We'll see how successful we are at that, of course.
Now, Bob Jensen, in your new book, Citizens of the Empire, you have a good deal of discussion of the role of universities in American life today. And I want you to talk about that. But first, I'd like you to convey your story, which I think some of our listeners might be familiar with. After 9/11, as I recall, the president of your university, University of Texas, responded to some comments you made and called you and your views foolish. What was this all about?
Well, after 9/11, like a number of people around the country, I thought it was important to put forward a critical view of where Bush was clearly going to take the United States. That is, it was pretty clear from midday on 9/11 that the Bush administration was going to use that tragedy as a pretext to pursue foreign policy and pursue war to extend American control over the Middle East, Central Asia, and in that area. Well, you know, I wrote suggesting that that was inappropriate. I critiqued U.S. foreign policy. And because of the highly emotionally charged atmosphere after 9/11, there were a lot of people who complained. The public, much of the public in the state of Texas, was angry at me for having written those things. The president of the University of Texas responded, not with a kind of stirring defense of the role of universities in propagating knowledge and providing a space for dissent and a space for intellectual inquiry. As you point out, he called me foolish in public. Now, I don't want to overemphasize this because the effect of that on me was literally zero. I continued to do the work I do. I didn't really care what the president said about me. It was not the first time I had had scrapes with the administration here at UT. I have a long history of them being unhappy with me. So I'm a tenured professor. My job security is pretty set. I didn't care one way or the other what Larry Faulkner said about me. But what was important about it is that it was not so much aimed at me as it was aimed at the other faculty and students on campus saying, if you know what's good for you, keep your head down. And I heard from untenured faculty, I heard from graduate students. They said very clearly, in this atmosphere, even though I would like to be part of a political movement, even though I'd like to participate in public events, I don't feel that it's safe and I won't do it. So the effect of Faulkner's comments was very efficient in a sense. It didn't shut me up, but I'm not sure that was even the most important goal. The goal was to placate the public that was angry with what I had done and to make sure that the campus didn't, you know, become a hotbed of actual intellectual engagement. And that's what's so sad about it because, you know, we have one of the most amazing higher education systems in the world. In fact, it's, you know, probably in the history of the world, the most extensive and well-funded
system. So you're saying we're the greatest nation in the world here?
No, I'm saying that our higher education system is really quite amazing. The technical sophistication of the American university system, when you think of all of the knowledge that's been produced, I'm not saying it's perfect, and I think you might agree that, for instance, the incredible penetration of the corporate world into the contemporary university is a serious problem. But my point is there's a lot of resources here on my campus, on your campus, on all sorts of campuses around the country. And in a healthy society, and I mean a society that's healthy both in intellectual and in political terms, campuses should be centers not only of study for students and faculty, but they should be centers of community engagement. That is, when there's a crisis in the country, it seems to me people should look to universities with all of the expertise and all of the learning that goes on there. People have a right to look to universities as a place to have that engagement. And what was so sad, and this is sort of the center of my critique in the book, is the University of Texas didn't do that. And in fact, most universities in this country, the overwhelming majority of universities, didn't hold themselves out to the public as a place where people could come to engage. And I think the reason they didn't do that is simple fear. Because if you really become a space for open intellectual inquiry, there will be controversy. There will be people who take different sides. And that is what the administration here was afraid of, and that's why I was attacked. Not because I'm so special, just because they wanted to make sure that real public engagement didn't happen here at the University of Texas.
Well, actually, Bob, I know you are a very modest man, but I think the fact that you were attacked also is that there weren't a lot of people doing what you were doing on September 12th. Most people were, in fact, intimidated and cowed and staying pretty quiet about the issues you raised, issues that now, I mean, are not really debated about. But at that time, took tremendous courage, so I think you deserve a pat on the back.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, but it was also, these were acts that I took as part of political groups. It wasn't me out there by myself. I mean,
right.
I happen to be a professor, and I have, you know, alleged prestige in the culture. But, you know, I work as part of a political group, and there's a lot of people behind me, often doing work that doesn't get noticed simply because they don't have the same kind of status in the culture I do.
We're talking to Bob Jensen today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got a little over 10 minutes left, and I want to remind listeners that this is a tape show. We did it a few days before going on air because I'm not going to be in town on Sunday when this is being aired. So don't try to call in. Just sit back and listen and enjoy. You know, I hear you talk about the university system. We've been talking about the media. We've been talking about the power of the government. All together, you add these things up, and it might make some of our listeners want to look for the nearest window to jump out of. But your book is not meant to really depress and demoralize people, is it?
No, not at all. And if anybody is tempted to jump out the window, just make sure you order the book online before you jump, as a gift to somebody you leave behind, perhaps. No, I mean, here we really have to pay attention to history. I have people all the time who come up to me and say, oh my God, you know, if the world is as bad as you say it is, why in the world should we even go on? I was just having a conversation with a very good friend who's prone to depression around these matters. But I think you can lift that depression quickly by just looking at history. Every progressive political change that's ever happened in this country has been the product of long struggle that began against what seemed to be forces that couldn't be beaten. And in fact, you could look in world history and say the same thing. That is, when people originally took on the issue of slavery in the United States, it was, you know, impossible. Who could imagine slavery ending in that, especially in any short time frame?
Oh, I mean, it had been in existence for centuries.
Yes, and it seemed to be almost part of the natural human, you know, system. It was almost as if it came down from the heavens, and how could you imagine stopping it? But, you know, you don't even have to go that far back. You look at the civil rights movement. I use that example because I think it's very important. At the end of the 19th century, in the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, the Supreme Court said separate but equal is fine. African Americans can be second-class citizens. We don't care. You've got no rights that really matter. I mean, it was just an absolute defeat for the civil rights movement of that era. You go into the early 20th century, there's lynchings everywhere. Violence against blacks is incredible. You know, if you were to come down in 1950 in the United States, and have somebody tell you they were part of the civil rights movement, you could easily say, why even bother? You can't win. The power is too stacked against you. This is a white supremacist society through and through. You might as well give up. But, of course, within 10 years, that political landscape had changed amazingly. Now, I don't want to make it sound like, you know, we reached the land of milk and honey on the question of race. But the point is that all of those victories that were won came as the result of a long movement that had struggled often against what seemed to be unbeatable odds. And it happened because people had faith. People continued to work. And here's something to ponder. They continued to work even when they might have known or had reason to suspect that the political gains that they could possibly achieve would happen long after they died. Well, that's having, you know, the long view. That's understanding that political change sometimes is the product of struggle over a long period of time. Now, if that's too depressing, let's remember one other thing about history is you can never tell when that political change is happening. I use the example of the 1950s. Think about the 1950s. I was born in 58, so I didn't experience this directly. But I talked to people who were alive and active during the 1950s, and you can't imagine a more locked-down time politically in this country. You can barely imagine a more repressive society, not only politically with the witch hunts, the communist conspiracy cases, the way in which people were being fired and blacklisted. I mean, this was a period in time in which even the culture was kind of very repressive. Okay, well, when I was born in 1958, if you looked around, you would have said, listen, there isn't a lot of hope for progressive politics in the United States. Yet within a decade, this country was literally on fire. Everything was changing, not only politically, but culturally as well. You can't look at history and ever predict when the moment is going to be right for real serious political change. That means that even at moments where it does seem like power is, you know, amassed against those of us who have progressive political values, it doesn't mean you give up. It means you realize that there's just a lot of work to do, and if you want to take history as a guide, the time to get busy is, of course, always now. I kind of sometimes feel like a real estate agent. You know, real estate agents, if you ask them when's the right time to buy, they always say now. And in that case, in that sense, it's the same for politics. When's the right time to get politically active? Well, as far as I can tell, it's always now. Because even if the conditions aren't ripe for change today, you can't tell when they're going to be ripe, and it's a lot better off if you've got political institutions, if you've got grassroots groups that are formed and functional. So, you know, I work with a group here in Austin that, you know, we're not changing the world overnight, but we're trying to do work, political education work that's very important, and we hope that when conditions do change and organizing can be more successful, we'll be ready. We'll have an infrastructure in place. We'll have communication channels in place. And we'll have earned the trust of people by being there through thick and thin. That's how politics happens.
Well, that certainly makes sense to me. I remember when I was in graduate school back in the 1980s, I had a professor who was originally from South Africa. And this is like 1986 or 7. And he told me one day that all his remaining family in South Africa was leaving South Africa because they were liberal whites and they were opposed to apartheid. Mm-hmm. And they determined that there was absolutely no chance apartheid would ever be overthrown, that the forces of darkness were in total command of South Africa. Well, 3 years later, Nelson Mandela was president of South mm-hmm. Africa. So, you know, they certainly missed the boat. They lived there their whole lives and they completely misjudged the balance of power in that society.
The other thing I write about in the book, and I think it's very important, is to realize that even when you don't win, I mean, it's nice to win. I'd like to be part of a political movement that wins.
Yeah, that's an interesting feeling.
I've yet to have that experience.
Yeah.
But the point I've made over and over again is that I've lived my life both as a very politically active person and as someone who was completely depoliticized when I was younger. And I can tell people, in all honesty, I'm a much happier person today than I was 20 years ago. That is, as someone who's engaged in political movements, even political movements that are marginal in some sense, that aren't winning, I find that my life is richer, it's deeper, it has more meaning. I find that my relationships with people that I've made through politics are very satisfying. They produce a kind of friendship that's very different than friendship that develops in purely social realms.
We're talking
so there's a benefit to all of us to engaging in this kind of politics.
Bob Jensen, our guest today on Media Matters. We've only got a few minutes left, Bob, but let's talk a little more tangibly about what people can do concretely. I mean, if someone listening to this show, a lot of our listeners are very interested in politics, so they wouldn't be listening to the show, but some are just sort of tuning the dial, maybe not that interested. What recommendations do you make to people when they say, well, what can I do? I mean, the power of darkness, this is so powerful. I mean, I'm at a loss to think of what I can do to make a difference.
Well, there are two things they should do immediately. One is go out and buy my book, of course, but then they should go out and buy your new book, The Problem of the Media, which I must say, and I was not paid to say this, I think is really a great summation of what's wrong with the media at all levels, at the corporate level, at the professional level. But a more serious answer is that all of us have the capacity to get engaged at the grassroots level. We don't have to have money. We don't have to have PhDs to do that. There are groups in many, many communities that are trying to organize people around some of these issues. In my case, let me tell you the easiest way to answer it is to tell you what I do in my local political work. We have a group called the Third Coast Activist Resource Center. Well, that's just a fancy name for a group that tries to do public education. We put on events. Tonight, we're going to have a screening of a film that critiques U.S. media coverage of the Israel-Palestine conflict. We're trying to do education so that people in the U.S. understand better why the news media cover that conflict the way they do and what's the role of the United States in all of that. Well, again, that's not going to change the world overnight, but it's trying to build a movement in which people have more and better access to information, can do the analysis that we need to do to understand how the world works, and then change it. Now, these groups do all sorts of things. Some people engage in writing letters to members of Congress. That alone isn't going to change the world, but that's the kind of thing that can matter.
Now, Bob,
people
you...
can do media activism, work on writing op-eds and letters, all sorts of things available out there.
Now, some of this is just putting pressure on people who are in office to change their policies from the grassroots pressure. Are you at all involved in doing work for specific candidates, getting involved in the electoral system at all?
I have never found for me that the electoral system was a good channel for my political interests. That is, I'm a radical critic of the system. I'm anti-capitalist. I'm anti-empire. These are not points of view that sort of have a lot of traction in mainstream electoral politics these days. And there's so much work to do around public education. There's so much work to do around organizing grassroots groups to resist American foreign policy, for instance. My own choice is to work through a more popular grassroots kind of group. But, of course, the electoral system is where decisions are made, and I think lots of people make perfectly plausible choices to get involved in that. If they do, my only recommendation is people not be naive about what can be accomplished in the electoral system when this country is as dominated by the concentrated wealth and power of corporations as it is. We have to understand the electoral system offers opportunities, but that is not the sole path to a society that takes freedom, justice, and equality seriously.
Bob Jensen, we've only got a few seconds left, and in that time, I'd like you just to tell our listeners what media you use to get a sort of a grasp of the world. Where would you recommend they go to really get a better understanding of the U.S. role in the world, just in a few seconds?
Well, I think we have to keep reading the mainstream media. There's often a lot of good information in it. I think the alternative media in the U.S., websites like zmag.org, for instance, that bring together a lot of good alternative reporting. And, of course, the non-U.S. press, the foreign press. In English, there's The Guardian, The Independent in England. There's the press on the subcontinent, The Hindu in India, things like that. All of those, when read in conjunction, can help people get a pretty clear idea of what's going on in the world.
Well, Bob Jensen, I want to thank you for being our guest today in Media Matters. It's been a real honor and privilege to have you, as always. Bob Jensen's the author of the new book, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, published just in the last month by City Lights Press. Bob, again, thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Bob. Thanks.
And I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back 1 week from today with Jeff Cohen as our guest. And I want to thank Victor Picard, my producer, as always, for his terrific work. See you in 1 week.